for the attention of the patients. With all the footnotes and quotations.
Really implies that I will not be talking about these missions that you expect them to be talked about. Indeed, I think my co-presenter will be talking about these issues that you expect them to be talking about, and if he doesn't, you can blame him, since I've just charged him with doing it. What I do have to say is very much centered around law. But in a cyber environment, and when I think of the new millennium, it's hard not to think about a network cyber environment. Law has many expressions. It's not just what, say, the U.S. Congress might pass and the President might sign that binds us in a way that's the very fabric of the software that defines us. And that's part of what I'm going to talk about today. So it's a different kind of law than you might be used to. And I want to start off with a question, one designed to kind of take us out of the woods and the trees and actually get a bird's eye view of the forest. And the question that I was thinking about what I was saying today is this. We live in an information economy. That's so much of a truism that we take it for granted when we see statements such as that. You know, it's an information culture. So much of what we're doing now is about knowledge workers. And information itself is so key to everything. We acknowledge, of course, that information, and maybe even knowledge, is power. But I wonder why libraries are worrying about the relevance and obsolescence. Now, you might say, I'm already putting words in your mouth, that is such a worry. But in the people I talk to in this community, it does seem to me, actually, quite a strong worry that libraries are being left on the sidelines. Somehow, this information revolution is taking place, and not only is there a worry that somehow library visits are down, usage of libraries is down, according to some metrics, but even with respect to the Internet itself, really the Internet on parallel engine of information dissemination, and yet I don't see libraries at its core. Now, why is that? Why is it that the first place somebody goes to for reference? They don't know what they're looking for again. They have a general idea. They don't know how much the moon weighs. And they go on, and they don't go to the library online. They go to Yahoo. And they go to AltaVista or Ask Jeeves. Indeed, some of the librarians have talked to have a personal umbrella against Ask Jeeves. Because every question that is asked to Jeeves is a question that likely should have been asked to them when they thought Jeeves stole away. And I even say, you know, there's the answer that Jeeves gives. I mean, you know, how much does the moon weigh is the answer that is the sample. It's a sample question you're supposed to ask me what I suggest you type in. And if you're even very thorough, like how much is the earth weigh, you've already been somewhat confused. And I would hope that we could beat that standard if we try. So I offer two kinds of answers to this question. And again, understanding you may not even accept the premise of the question. So I offer two kinds of answers. The first is what I call a study this response. What is a study with response? To me, a study with response is a kind of parochial concern. It's saying, here we are, we're in an industry, we're in a business, it's the business of being libraries, of doing references in libraries, and we're getting left behind. That's bad. It's not fun to get left behind. We need a way to catch up. And again, that's what companies do whenever profits go down. It's what study with manufacturers at one point did. As they saw more and more surplus carriages populating the roads and saying, wait a minute, we might lose our racket. We need to somehow figure out how to be whether that's true we are manufacturers if we are to survive in the era. Now, I think there are a perfectly good set of legitimate worries around the money risk problem. But to me, I think that the money risk problem isn't all there is. Here's an example of how to see the money risk answer. The New York Times, Abe Kupfer at College Board is joining Bull Rush on the web. I don't know how many people heard this news when it came out. The members of College Board, the people behind the SAT and other acronymized tests for which somebody filled out a bubble and eventually is told what their work is. The College Board has decided it wants to go online. And how is it going online that we're a .com vendor? It's going through, for instance, as people go online, that's the first thing you think when they go online is, I see, I go online and get my score. And that's true. You'll be able to go online and score AC and get your score. But there's always so much more. You see, the character wants to be AC film. And why would you go online to get your score? It must be if you're interested in going to college. In which case, you must need dorm furniture. So there's a dorm furniture. And you might not use dorm furniture, which means that there should be an option. We can have people who are taking the SATs they're going to be very interested with each other. And if they're students who start thinking that way, yes, the possibilities are truly endless. And indeed, Colin Ford has come up with a business plan, teaching in Larry Johnson, venture capital and partnership. And I'm hoping that you create a certain side of this. And their explanation is to me, the other is, hey, we got to pay for the website somehow, so that's how we're going to do it. But to me, it's a little bit striking as if working all day so you can pay the babysitter to make sure that you're better away working. You start wondering, well, what was the purpose of the website for which you need this kind of website to pay for it? But that's a different kind of question than the money book question. You could imagine, possibly, this being a successful website from the point of view of earning a college for all money. But there might be other ways when we might try to express what would be success for an online venture, particularly if the entity known to take on the online venture, become part of the online world, isn't just a .com. And I know, I hear odd noises in the room as well. They're working on it. Okay, so, aside from the value response, I offer a values response. My idea is that yahoo.com and I need my
I could just bellow if that would be. Let me grab that music and make it.
Okay.
Should I bellow it in the
Okay. So it's not the value response, but it's the value response. It says, wait a minute, we're not just yahoo.com. That's not the ideal for virtual records, even though it's wildly successful. It's the site people go to figure out where to go to next. And helping to frame our place in that world, to me, is much more effective to start thinking in terms of values before thinking in terms of raw competition. How do we out-compete the dot-coms of the world? So to me, the value question regresses to us, what do we stand for? Can we articulate together what we stand for? Now, there's a literature on things people stand for and things that institutions stand for. Business schools tend to tie them up into articles and case studies and such. They tend to transform values into core purpose. What's your core purpose? Your raison d'etre. And here are some core purposes that I extracted from one of the famous articles on the subject. Here's Cargill. Inc., I believe it's a pharmaceutical concern. To improve the standard of living around the world. Here's 3M. To solve unsolved problems innovatively. I actually could imagine ripping that off and having that be a kind of reference core purpose. Nike. To experience the emotion of competition winning and sucking competitors. Just have to say a few things, you can tell me Nike in the group I don't know how much readily adaptable that is to reference that in the middle of the day. The children in the variety for our purposes. Tammy May, to strengthen the social fabric by continually democratizing home ownership. Now, Fannie Mae strikes me as of interest because Fannie Mae is a quasi-public, quasi-private entity. It's not just another lender that, at the end of the day, corporate supplies have a simple return to make on investment and wants to maximize it as much as practicable. Fannie Mae says, wait a minute, we are charged by the U.S. government, even if we're not fully controlled by it, with some kind of value in mind that's apart from the typical dynamics of the market. Since I'm on this among so much of my dragons, I thought about it Friday. There's a column that says, really, the company's vision. So I hope I gave in proper form. Okay, so we have the question, what do we stand for? Here are some hypotheses, right? This is for me to tell you that since I am up on talking, I'm going to offer some thoughts that may be worthy of discussion later on, where if we have time in this particular session to talk about my gear. Design of knowledge. That seems like a given, but that has all sorts of dimensions to it. Does it mean dissemination of knowledge for free? Is it access to knowledge? Is that what dissemination of knowledge means? Does anybody have a claim to come in and ask a question and get an answer and be pointed to the source? Or do you do at some point a wallet biopsy, either because you are looking to see how much money they have to pay for their answer, or because somebody with whom you contract perhaps a source in your library that has restrictions on its distribution says, I'm sorry, it's only for a certain kind of students, or I'm sorry, it's only for people who subscribe and have a blue sticker on their card as compared to no sticker on their card. And if you can see, I'm trying to get the values that are more than just kind of excellence. Now, everybody stands for excellence, you know, achieve it. We want values that actually express something real and differentiating from the rest of the world. So the second part is to look for free access to knowledge. Is that something for which, you might say, libraries generally stand? Here's another one, community ownership of knowledge. What might that mean? And here I am actually some of this is flipping them to parents to think about legal issues. Because the ways in which information and knowledge work their way into a library environment are changing drastically as we approach the new millennium. We're going from some fairly well-known ways that you acquire information and then share it with the public at large, ways that are governed by law, copyright, for example, which has to be sure acceptance, such as fair use, and you know you have no idea what it is and invitation, it's just kind of mean, do your best and hope they don't want to complain. Okay. So we know about that, even if we can't stipulate to it. There are all sorts of new formulas coming down. Formulas enabled by the internet, by technology. And even approaches academic of commons. You think of the library as kind of a commons, a place that once the information is in there, it's available for people to come from all points and take a look at it. And you can see there's multiple facets maybe circling the same core value. And of course, reflect my own views, but I offer up as a means of discussion. Here's another one, it's a little bit separate, it's feeling from bias. That if you go to yahoo.com and you type in something that gets it back at you, on what basis did it give you that answer? Now, one basis may be they really tried hard to give you an answer right with the question. Because after all, the more relevant they can be, vis-a-vis their competitors, the more often people will use them. So that gets you some mileage, but that's not everything, because they may have other customers. You may not be the only customer. The customer may be somebody who wants to place an ad, and the ad gets shown when you do the search, and they get more money from that ad than they do from you arriving to do the search. So, how does Yahoo make its message? I don't know. Nobody knows. It's a trade secret, right? You ask Yahoo, they're not going to tell you. That's part of what makes them different. Now, we have some of them on some of the search engines, GoTo.com, for example, a recent IPO. Went very well, actually. That was the value, I think, on the first day. GoTo.com formula is that it has an auction system. It's quite open about it. Those who want to have matches take place from searches, suppliers of content, significant phrase by the way, that's real Shakespeare, supplier of content. You know, these are arguing from content world. It's odd if you think of this as like some amorphous gelatinous mass content that I guess. GoTo.com says we're going to pay people who have contact launch or sites that want to have people visit it, and they will literally bid on viewers. So if somebody has some bicycle, GoTo.com, so they'll figure out who would pay the most to give a match for their bicycle. And that's how they do their matches. Now, is the public enraged over this? I don't know. I doubt the public is really thought about it that much. And sometimes the public comes in, they're looking for something, they want an answer. It might well be that the model they are bringing to these search engines is one they're giving from a library environment. And they're in school or something, they went to the library, asked a question, got some pointers, and went on. But the values didn't carry over into the state. And you could actually see, once they're into it, people starting to get more sensitive to, oh, I see. Maybe I'm very sensitive to giving information free from bias. Now, of course, bias is a subject, right? We all have bias. This is a postmodern world, and it says that there's no such thing as objectivity. So maybe that is really for all human motives. I think that's what we're talking about. Somehow, at least you're not getting paid by the reader's guide to our literature, from them that way, rather than some other direction. You might be biased, but at least it's not kind of a crass marketing relationship. I think that why does it matter? It doesn't even matter what we stand for. And this again borders on law. There's a speech property trade-off. The speech property trade-off. I believe there has been a fundamental creeping misconception in our culture. The misconception is that intellectual property is property. Everything we know about property, like chairs and tables, applies to intellectual property. And this reason why this misconception, which is fully about the way the framers intended it, has come about. Jefferson, at the time of the ratification of the Constitution, was greatly concerned about the copyright clause. That was the clause of the Constitution that we were aware of with the later First Amendment. Clearly concerned speech, right? To create intellectual property, to say this is yours and you can prevent somebody from copying it. This is that the government can't speak. There's a one-to-one trade-off. You can't have intellectual property without a restriction on everybody but the owner's speech. That's what creates the property. And Jefferson didn't like that. Jefferson had wonderful language, which I have in front of me, I'll read to you. Language was basically about the nature of ideas. But you can't teach those in part. The ones out there are available from person to person. And when you give it away, it's not like you've lost anything. You still have the idea, and the person to whom you've given it has it as well. Now, again, for people who think this is like some new revelation, and like they're discovering it and showing economic models, but sure enough, that's true. Jefferson knew this and wrote it down and published it a while ago, and sure enough, the idea has gotten around. His liberties were modified by a limited term, at that time, 7 years of exclusive monopoly, probably enough so that he'd be remunerated for your efforts to produce it, after which it goes into the commons. No legal claim, even to a literal copying of the very expression, as he put out. That term has since been extended somewhat. Just recently last year, the Fundamental Copyright Term Extension Act, passed by unanimous consent in the House and on a great vote in the Senate, where nobody actually had to kind of eyes and nays, anyone actually put your vote on paper, it passed and was signed, and the term of copyright is now roughly 95 years. Ratified retroactively, so works that were about to come into public domain are not coming into public domain. And by the way, the pleasure of our center, my center, the Berkman Center, has lost constitutional challenge to that, and for a number of reasons, it's not a limited time, as the Constitution contemplated, but it is promoting the progress of the use of the arts and the sciences, which is what the copyright clause says the copyright needs to do, particularly to give it to works that are been created. There's not much of an incentive to create when it's already there. It's not like you can make them created again. So to do this retroactively is a very strange giveaway indeed. So Jefferson was worried that his words were modified by a limited term and by the fact that no matter how much you lock up a particular expression, ideas are still free. I think Jefferson was right at the time, as really amusing to be worried today. And that was the compromise that I'm just mentioning. So, in that 1994, here's the word for word, an echo of Jefferson's view of the world. In that 1994, copyright owners looked at the internet and said, copyist copying, instant copying, perfect copying. This is terrible. What a disaster. Before you know it, something got online, everybody will have it, and they won't have to pay for it. Then you know the information at all. And John Gray Barlow, former lyricist of the Grateful Dead, from Cyber Thinker, wrote a wonderful piece called The Economy of Ideas in Wired magazine, in which he said, sure enough, copyright is dead, I for one cheer that, but as an empirical matter, give it up. There's no way in this new network environment you can protect it. Once it's out there, it's out there, so you can try, and sure enough, in 1994, there were attempts to tighten copyright laws to account for this new Xerox machine level quantum jump of the ability of information to jump around. That's the final give up. There's just no way. The net is bigger than all of you. What do we know about the internet 2000? The internet was the turn of the millennium. It was a very different internet than the internet 1994. The internet was the turn of the millennium. The internet, the turn of the millennium, is one in which, just last week, a new website came into being, trustedpc.com. Trustedpc.com is a consortium for the Packard, Compaq, IBM, leading the suspect. Certainly, I would trust in PC. What you might ask is a trusted PC. A trusted PC is a device that can be trusted by the person putting information into it as against the person using it. So, for instance, a trusted Netscape would be one to which you would send information, tag it, it says, do not copy this, and Netscape would say, oh, yeah, I won't. You can trust me. And the user feeds the information, highlights it, they have to edit the copy, and it's grayed out. So when the file consents, it says, that would be 25 cents, please. Click OK to send what is have your credit card debited, and print. Be careful with me if they're not printed after all. Now, true, pretty much any system there is, you can hack it, but not everyone is a hacker. And if you show up for 25 cents, it's not clear that you upload all that hacker. Because there is a sort of nickel and diming of information, a kind of numerization of it that just wasn't possible before. And did I suggest maybe contrary to the price of value and the value of the First Amendment, but even the Copyright Act? The Copyright Act is a battle, just by Congress, because we didn't leave that profit, but they're not total. In Spanish, for example, here in the library, is the first fan doctrine. That's a doctrine that says, if I send you a book, it's your book, you can lend it out to people, and even though for every person you lend it out, I'm leaving a sale, because you're not buying it from me anymore, they're just borrowing it. You can do that. Copyright does not stop lending. Now, the trusted system can be configured in any sort of way they want. You can configure a trusted system so it doesn't allow lending. So that somebody who is looking at the information can't just hit the forward button and send it out to someone else. You can never see it, can't just fair use. You only highlight three words of that piece in Netscape and say, I want a copy of that, I want fair use for that, come on, say it's a big poem. The computer says, no, sure, we can't copy it, you can't copy it. This is a new era of private education, and it goes beyond even the licensing agreements you may be faced with as new kinds of software with information attached to them are working their way into libraries. And exactly how to deal with this is a good question, but it's still a debate that has been stuck over, it has not been fully engaged. So with that being said, what would this library of 2001 look like? Is it going to be one for which, before you set out that book, you present your card that identifies the characteristics about who you are. And again, if you're a student, all right, you get one price. If you're not, you get a higher price. And then what you get is not allowed to be shared automatically with others. And what role does the library have in saying, these are the kinds of deals, either licensing through contract or just through technology, the kinds of trusted systems we will allow into our doorstep. And due to the extent that we're thinking about library online, you might be asking, what kind of library do we want to look like online? Will it be a library that requires a trusted PC on the other side in order to engage between the people? Another problem, of course, is being anonymous. So you want to go to the library, you just browse, you just browse. The new trusted system could require identification of some kind, and even for browsing, you're clear in everything you're interested in. Now, I don't suggest there's anything particularly sinister about it. It's just that they can later send you junk mail based on your interest. But certainly in free society, there are issues about being able to read an answer. So here's an example right out of the front. This is a Matter Matters newsletter. I'm a member of the senior commentator at Matter House. And this is what I read just the other day, 24th of December. Don't tell me your notes. This is the student. You may be making any kind of businesses without the biometric of some students to post your website. Please remember this important statement on page 302 of the handbook to students. Try telling your students to read it. Students who know what we have papers or translations or who are employed by students to a print paper company may be required to withdraw. Very odd, isn't it? You take a note from the lecture, and you should dare to say your note. Now, sure, it's not like a transcription. This is not a copyright issue, right? You're paraphrasing. You're just taking the idea and you're putting it on paper. And if you should do it, tell it. You might have to withdraw. Now, for, to me, the purpose of getting a professional degree, getting a school for your record, is just tell it. I think you go out and say, I learned some stuff, and now I'm going to tell you about it, from Jair or whomever. Now, I think I'm not playing this good bet. But who's the fact that thanks again, university, and Belknock.com, at least not supposed to be .com, but their values are tied into realizing information is a gold mine, and it's one for which they should be posting fairly strict sentries at the entrances and exits. And anything that comes out of it ought to be approved by the university, ought to be served by the university, and I'm sorry, students, you paid your money. I'm telling you to step into the classroom, but don't think you're taking it out with you when you go. I really have another one on time. Let me make this the last slide. Possible bad student barriers. You might encounter it in a university or library environment. Faculty barrier number one, faculty and university. The faculty and university realize that there is value being created here. And that's the rubber faculty generating through classes, through research, etc. And there can be disputes over who owns it, because who gets the profit from it when it gets sold. Capitalism never at least got an argument and just about left the pot. Now really, there might be a third party to that argument that then gets ignored, maybe the public at large. And it makes the university want to ask itself, as it's carving up that pie, is this really what we want to be doing? Is this really what we stand for? If we don't do this, are we doing the bankrupt? Well, there are other models by which we actually make sure we pay our bills on time and grow, and then still make sure the other values we have. Talking about problem number two, faculty and university is sponsored. We're seeing more and more of it, where somebody will come in with money to support research. Microsoft, of course, is on my team, so here's $27 million, it happened 2 weeks ago. There are other instances in which they sponsor the research, but here's the term. We get to get our results, we get to say where they go later, and yeah, maybe 5 years from now, kind of got declassifying documents, you can release them to the public, sounds a lot like copyright. We have a send that term, that's, you know, that's the value. You get money, we get research, hey, we're all there. Again, I suggest there may be another party at the table. A party without an easy recourse to a bill, a bill that may be represented in this room, depending on the values within the library establishment, that ought to be there. And finally, topic line number three, what I call a simple disk. And this is when somebody says, well, that's what it is in the library. I could put a CD-ROM research workstation there, and it's going to have stuff to keep it with them. And here's a long list of terms, just down at the bottom. No cost to you, it's just like having a paper in the corner. Indeed, it's like having a paper in the corner. So they're going to put clippers in, they're going to discover it, they're going to go to the library, you get foot traffic, you're giving information out, and we'll make the terms with that. In fact, we'll even give you a cut. How does that sound? And then we'll leave it. How does that sound? So this is a long way of talking about legal issues. The one that I hope kind of gives you the big picture and at least help you to ask, if not come up with a common answer, to what we really stand for. That the Millennium Term, I don't yet see library.org up on the net. I do not see a bill representing dissemination of knowledge of public interest, not to replace the .com voice, bless the .com voice, bless them all. We already need them. But not everybody should be a shopping mall. And with that, not so bright up. I guess I will deal with questions or see what the thoughts that we should just proceed to the next step of the answer. Thank you very much. And speaking of advertising, the website for our center is cyber.law.harvard.edu. And I welcome you to visit and see many of the projects we're doing which bear on the issues that I'm talking about. cyber.law.harvard.edu. Yes. Yeah. Tech source. Yeah. Or not.
I'm just trying to say market websites and they fall into your institution and you can tell they come with a plan of standing and that they will frame it with your institution around the web page.
Oh, it's kind of like these newsletters that the dentist should be told. You can send a newsletter to your patients and we'll give you all the content, but you can make it look like it's coming from you.
Yeah,
kind of
thing.
Well, certainly, if the information is being generated by one of the two parties, as long as they sign an agreement that says this is how we will represent it, I don't know of any strong truth in advertising, that's what you're getting at, a kind of truth in advertising sort of thing, that would do it. Because, you know, for instance, when the New York Times puts out its paper, even if it doesn't use a byline, it's coming from a reporter somewhere, maybe they got it from AP or something, and they might have agreed with AP, you know what, they don't want to put the AP in parentheses anymore.